Today is Thursday, August 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. Coming up...
Diets that are high in grains, nuts and vegetables have a lower carbon footprint than those that are high in meat, and they lead to better health outcomes.
That story and more is ahead on today's International Edition. A United Nations panel says eating less meat and adopting a plant-based diet could reduce greenhouse gas emissions and help tackle climate change. Its report presents the first ever comprehensive look at the whole land climate system. One panelist said, "We want to get across the message that every action makes a difference." Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
Most scientists agree that greenhouse gas emissions must be reduced from all sectors, including land and food, to keep global temperatures from rising an uncomfortable 2 degrees Celsius in coming years. A UN report says agriculture, forestry, and other types of land use account for nearly a quarter of human greenhouse gas emissions. The authors say about one-third of all food produced is lost or wasted, and that rectifying that could reduce pressure on land, improve food security, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 3, Jim Skay, explains.
Some diets require more land and water and lead to higher emissions than others. For example, diets that are high in grains, nuts, and vegetables have a lower carbon footprint than those that are high in meat, and they lead to better health outcomes. But, of course, dietary choices are influenced by local production practices and cultural habits.
The report released Thursday warns food production will fall and hunger increase as global warming increases. It says low-income countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean will be the most affected. The IPCC says an international finance mechanism is being established to help developing countries adapt to and mitigate the impact of climate change. The co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2, Deborah Roberts, tells VOA governments must do more to support people who manage land, like smallhold farmers, in order to keep that land productive.
An important element within that discussion was the ability for smallholders to access credit. So the importance of accessing financial resources to be able to change the way you manage the land is important. A very big message which is stressed is the importance about efforts to reduce poverty and with the view of eradicating poverty.
The report finds some 500 million people live in areas that experience desertification. It says those areas are more vulnerable to climate change and extreme events, including drought, heat waves, and dust storms. The scientists are calling for action to halt land degradation. They cite options to prevent or adapt to further climate change. The options include the development of extreme heat and drought-resistant crops, practicing organic farming, conserving pollinators, and harvesting rainwater. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Donald Trump visited the sites of last weekend's mass shootings that left 31 dead and dozens more wounded on Wednesday. He and First Lady Melania Trump flew to El Paso, Texas, late Wednesday after starting the day in Dayton, Ohio. While White House press agents told reporters that hospital staff, first responders, and family members of the victims were excited to see him, the president was greeted by protesters in Dayton. In El Paso, Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke spoke to hundreds of people at a similar gathering. VOA's Richard Green has this report.
Shortly before departing the White House for his trips to Ohio and Texas, President Trump once again defended himself against growing criticism that his comments embrace and encourage white nationalism. He went so far as to suggest that the suspected gunman in the Ohio shooting supported his liberal opponents.
So my critics are political people. They're trying to make points. In many cases, they're running for president and they're very low in the polls. A couple of them in particular, very low in the polls. If you look at Dayton, that was the person that supported, I guess you would say, Bernie Sanders, I understood. Antifa, I understood. Elizabeth Warren, I understood. Had nothing to do with President Trump. So these are people that are looking for political gain. I don't think they're getting it. And as much as possible, I've tried to stay out of that.
The warm greeting Trump received from local dignitaries when he arrived in Dayton was in sharp contrast to the angry protesters that lined the streets outside the hospital, where he and the First Lady visited with some of the 27 people wounded in last Sunday's shooting that left 9 people dead. Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown says he urged the president to push his Senate Republican allies to take swift action on new gun control legislation already approved in the Democratic-controlled House.
Both the mayor and I asked the president to call on Senator McConnell to move, to bring the Senate back in session this week, to tell the Senate that he wants the background checks bill that has already passed the House, that he wants it on the floor. I asked the president to promise to me and to the American people that he will sign that bill after he's spoken out in support of it with Senator McConnell.
In El Paso, where 22 people were killed at a department store just hours before the Dayton shooting, Trump praised emergency personnel who took part in assisting the victims and capturing the shooter.
All over the world, they're talking about the job you've done as police, as law enforcement, as first responders. The job you've done is incredible, and everybody's talking about it. And I wanted to come and thank you, because you're very special people.
But emotions also ran high in El Paso, which sits on the border with Mexico. The suspected gunman in that attack, Patrick Crucius, reportedly posted a white supremacist message online hours before the shooting that expressed intense hatred towards Hispanics.
We have a president who demonizes communities like this one.
Among those criticizing Trump's visit Wednesday was Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke, who formerly represented El Paso in Congress. The president blasted O'Rourke on Twitter before arriving in El Paso, mocking him for his low standing in the polls and accusing him of faking Hispanic heritage. Richard Green, VOA News, Washington.
Here are other major stories from around the globe. 2 people died in a missile engine unit explosion in northern Russia on Thursday. The RIA news agency reports that Russia's Ministry of Defense says no dangerous substances, such as radiation, were released into the atmosphere. The blast also injured 6 others at the military testing site. Canadian police say they believe 2 fugitives suspected of killing a woman from North Carolina and her Australian boyfriend, along with another man, have been found dead in the wilderness of the province of Manitoba. The hunt for the 2 teenage men started in late July in British Columbia and spread across 3 provinces. Japan says it will allow a shipment of chemicals used in high-tech materials like semiconductors to be sent to South Korea for the first time since stricter export controls went into place in early July. Japan will continue to review these types of high-tech shipments on a case-by-case basis. Approvals can take up to 90 days, but this time around, the review only took 30. Find more on these stories at our website, voanews.com, and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A Pentagon report that the Islamic State terror group is making a resurgence in both Syria and Iraq is causing a bit of a stir in the region, where most governments would like to see a definitive end to its saga. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media gave wide coverage to the U.S. Defense Department report that the Islamic State group is making a comeback in both Iraq and Syria amid widespread contempt for the organization. Most people in the region would like to see a quick end to Islamic State, which has caused death and destruction in a number of countries, including Iraq and Syria. Islamic State's alleged leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, purportedly appeared in a video in April claiming that the group would exact revenge for the loss of its so-called caliphate. U.S.-backed Kurdish militia fighters captured the group's last physical stronghold in the town of Baghouz in eastern Syria several months ago, but scattered reports of sleeper cell attacks in parts of Iraq and Syria persist. Reports about Baghdadi's whereabouts in recent years have placed him variously in Mosul, Iraq, along the Iraqi-Syrian border, and in Raqqa, Syria. Arab media have reported that he was wounded or near death on several occasions, yet the man in the video appears to have no battle scars and no obvious traces of hardship. Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mehdi said recently that Baghdad would continue to battle Islamic State with cooperation from its international partners and allies, and that many sleeper cells continue to exist.
تكلمنا في اللقاءات السابقة عن هذه المسألة مما يتطلب التعاون المستمر.
He says Iraq is cooperating with countries across the world to fight Daesh because any slack will cause cracks in the alliance against the group. He stresses that Iraq is working both domestically and with other countries to catch Islamic State sleeper cells and shut them down. He argues that Daesh is trying to regain its former status and that it no doubt still has many sleeper cells. The term Daesh is an Arab acronym for Islamic State. Joshua Landis, who heads the Department of International and Area Studies at the University of Oklahoma, says Islamic State remains a problem despite the destruction of its caliphate. He says that the group's ideology remains strong among the women and family members of Islamic State fighters that have been placed in the Al-Hol camp, and that many Islamic State fighters continue to carry out guerrilla attacks. Al-Hol is a Kurdish-run camp for those displaced from former Islamic State-controlled areas, including wives and children of former fighters. Syria's ambassador to the UN, Bashar al-Jafari, claimed during a recent Syrian dialogue session in the Kazakh capital Astana that he thinks that many foreign governments are supporting Islamic State in order to keep Syria in a perpetual state of chaos.
لم يعد هناك مجال للإنكار من أحد بوجاهة ما كانت تقوله الحكومة السورية من وجود دعم.
He says that there is no reason for anyone to doubt that there is foreign support for terrorism in Syria, be it Israeli, American, British, Turkish, or French. He adds that people in the West are beginning to acknowledge this, but that many continue to obscure its real nature and rejigger it from time to time to give a false picture of what is going on. No matter who is behind Islamic State and other terror groups in the area, though, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi says Arab states must combat the Islamic State ideology and defeat it.
أن ظاهرة الإرهاب بمختلف أشكالها وما يواكبها من تطرف ديني.
He says that all forms of terrorism and its ideology of hatred and discrimination remain at the forefront of threats facing the Arab and Islamic worlds, not to mention the world as a whole. Egypt has been trying to stamp out this ideology for many years. Destroying Islamic State's ideology is not an easy task, however. Theodore Karasik of Gulf State Analytics says that the indoctrination process has many vectors that help keep fighters sustained for another day of fighting. He says that terrorists need to be dealt with in a proactive way. Their support networks are internal, he says, and we need to remember that Islamic State is the richest terrorist group ever, with hundreds of millions of dollars. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Huntsman has stepped down after 2 years in his post as the top U.S. envoy to Moscow, calling it a historically difficult period in bilateral relations. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain looks at what his departure might mean for U.S.-Russia relations.
At his Senate confirmation hearing almost 2 years ago, then-nominee to be the U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman, accepted the tough job with open eyes.
I'm under no illusion that serving as the U.S. ambassador to the Russian Federation will be easy or simple. Our relationship with Russia is among the most consequential and complex foreign policy challenges we face.
Huntsman served in Moscow at a time when the U.S. intelligence community said Russia systematically interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, and the special counsel investigated ties between Moscow and then-candidate Donald Trump's campaign. It was a frustrating time to be in Russia, Mark Simakovsky told VOA.
And so in many ways, U.S.-Russian relations are hemmed in by the political radioactivity of the issue here in Washington and the mostly bipartisan consensus in Congress that we need to limit engagement and limit our relations with Moscow because of its nefarious activity.
In his resignation letter, Huntsman had some advice for his successor, saying, going forward, we must continue to hold Russia accountable when its behavior threatens us or our allies. Huntsman has served his country as an ambassador to Russia, China, and Singapore under Democratic and Republican administrations, and as the governor of his home state of Utah. Some reports say he may be considering another run for governor there. His departure comes at a time of a violent crackdown on anti-Kremlin protests, led by supporters of opposition party candidates barred from running for Moscow's city council. Russian police have detained more than 1,000 people in recent Saturday protests, and images of police beating citizens lying on the ground have captured global attention. In his resignation letter, Huntsman called on Russia to respect the rule of law and human rights. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says war with Iran would be the mother of all wars, and if the U.S. wants to negotiate with Tehran, it must lift all sanctions. Iran has also asked the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to push back against U.S. sanctions imposed on Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, calling it a dangerous precedent. While it's not clear what Guterres could do, some experts perceive sanctions on the foreign minister as a hurdle to any potential diplomatic moves toward negotiations with the U.S. VOA's senior analyst, Mohammed Al-Shanawi, spoke with Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East and a scholar at the Middle East Institute, about the impact of sanctions on the future negotiations between the two countries.
I don't agree that it forecloses entirely the possibility of potential diplomatic moves, but it certainly makes it much more difficult. I wouldn't have used the word dangerous. I would have said it was a very foolish move. After all, this was a channel that has proved very useful in the past. As one who has met a couple of times with Foreign Minister Javad Zarif after I left government, I can say that he's an extremely capable diplomat, and it seems like the principal U.S. complaint about Foreign Minister Zarif was that he was reflecting the views of the top Iranian leadership. And of course, that's what we expect a diplomat to do. A diplomat who doesn't do that is dangerously misleading. So it seemed to me that we were taking a step which simply made future diplomacy with Iran more difficult. I think that is not in the U.S. national interest. And I think that probably there are people in the Trump administration who already regret this and wish that it had been handled differently. Certainly that's the case of Senator Rand Paul, who was used as an emissary from the president to Foreign Minister Zarif and had offered an invitation to meet with the president.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said war with Iran is the mother of all wars, and if the United States wants to negotiate with Iran, it must lift all sanctions. What do you make of such a statement?
Well, I think that statement is primarily intended for public opinion, both Iranian public opinion and international public opinion. Certainly, it hasn't had a positive effect in the United States. It doesn't make us afraid of war with Iran, although I think a war with Iran would be a very serious matter for the United States, very much on the level of our war with Vietnam, which ended quite badly for the United States. It would be far more serious than our involvement in Iraq, for example, in 2003, and that was bad enough. But as far as the U.S. lifting all sanctions, that's obviously not a likely step precedent to some kind of diplomatic activity. We have had sanctions at least since 1980 of some kind, and the idea that they would all have to be lifted, I think there are certain sanctions that, in my view, should be lifted and could be lifted without damage to U.S. national interests that would enable us to resume some kind of diplomatic activity.
With the rising tension between the United States and Iran, can Oman, as a neutral country, play a mediating role as it did before the signing of the nuclear deal with Iran?
Oman is one of many governments that could play a mediating role, and the Omani government has indicated that it is quite prepared to do so. Sultan Qaboos has a well-known policy of trying to lower the level of tension, not only between the United States and Iran, but between the other Arab countries in the region and Iran. His foreign minister, Yusuf bin Alawi, is a very capable diplomat, and this is an area that where Oman can prove to be a good friend to the United States.
That was Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East and a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you think of a parrot, you probably think of a small, chatty bird. Paleontologists in Australia and New Zealand were looking through some 19 million-year-old fossils when they discovered what they say is the world's largest parrot. Named Heracles inexpectitus, the scientists' research suggests that this parrot stood about 1 full meter tall and weighed 7 kilograms. In an email to VOA, research leader Professor Trevor Worthy of Australia's Flinders University says since it was such a heavily built bird, it probably was unable to fly, so it spent most of its time on the ground. But Professor Worthy also pointed out that even the flightless kakapo, a living giant parrot, are skilled climbers. So he suspects Heracles inexpectitus would have been able to get up the trees and then could have glided down to the ground. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Pakistan has suspended the only passenger rail service linking it with India and banned the screening of Indian films in the country's cinemas a day after downgrading relations with New Delhi for its illegal revocation of the constitutional autonomy of Kashmir. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government announced on Monday it was revoking the special status granted to the disputed majority Muslim Himalayan region, which is claimed by both New Delhi and Islamabad. The unprecedented move fueled tensions between the nuclear-armed rival nations, who've already fought 2 wars over Kashmir. On Wednesday, Pakistan announced it was downgrading diplomatic and trade ties and ordered the expulsion of the Indian High Commissioner to Pakistan. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said he will complain to the United Nations Security Council about India's actions. One quick note back in time, in 2008, China opened the Summer Olympic Games with an extravaganza of fireworks and pageantry. And in 1974, U.S. President Richard Nixon, facing damaging new revelations in the Watergate scandal, announced he would resign the following day. And for today, that's going to do it. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, engineer Wojtek Zorniak, and managing editor Paul Alexander, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget the VOA mobile app where you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. Have a wonderful Thursday.